So I don't believe in heaven. Not in that traditional sense, that magical place of pleasure and utopia that often is parroted from pulpits like this. Figurative pulpits, right? But this Friday night, I feel like I saw a glimpse of what heaven might look like if it did exist. I was out with my husband and two of our friends at Our Bar. Now, if you don't know about Our Bar, it's really the only drinking community establishment for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer people in northern Colorado. There really aren't that many establishments that you can go to. And so we were there, and it reminded me of the first time that I went to a gay bar when I was in college, and that sense of seeing all the people, all the different types of people. Some people wearing clothes that you could tell this was the only place that they would wear those clothes, outside the privacy of their home for fear of what it would mean to walk out of their front door and go to work or meet a family member dressed like that. For decades, gay bars have been an oasis for queer people, a space in which the stories of our inferiority, of how our love is defective, are pushed and left somewhere else so that we can find community and friendship and connection in a world that does often seem to deny it. Now, what helped me glimpse the beauty of this moment more than just the fact that it was a gay bar was that it was a drag night. How many of you have seen drag before? Well, if you haven't, you need to rectify this. Drag is this art form that has emerged from queer people, and particularly queer people of color, in which usually men dress up in these elaborate feminine costumes. There's a whole vocabulary, a whole way of being. There is so much glitter and sequins that it's hard sometimes for your eyes to adjust. And so a drag show consists of many different drag queens lip-syncing and singing to songs of old. They did Aladdin that night and an amazing Beyonce. It was near the end of the first set, though, that I really realized that this might be what heaven looked like. It was when the host announced that the next act, the next queen, was going to come up and she was going to do stand-up comedy instead of lip syncing. And I was like, okay, never seen that before. And the woman who walks on stage, this drag queen, was a visibly disabled drag queen from rural Wyoming who absolutely slayed her stand-up routine. I mean, we were all cracking up. We were laughing, and then it got to a point that was really uncomfortable, and we were still laughing, and then we had to decide if we were going to continue to laugh, but we did. It was amazing. It was political. It was raunchy. It was raw. It was authentic, and it just made me realize what a beautiful moment this was to be here in Fort Collins, to be in a place where this bar existed, where this person would be able to come and dress up like society would not want them to delight us. There are few places in the world in which that inner power and beauty can be revealed to other people. There are few places that we welcome it fully. The places where the forces that would shackle or silence us are broken, and a perverse, raw freedom overflows. In that moment, I really sensed the presence of the holy in each of the people, all of the different types of queer people that were there, and that sense of being bound up to one another and connected to something more powerful than any of us alone. And it was in that moment of seeing what would be possible if we allowed our true selves to be shown that I had this sense of melancholy, actually. I was really into it, but also this shadow started to cross my heart because I started to feel the tenuousness of this moment. It made me think back centuries to Germany, actually. Because not many people know that in the turn of the 20th century in Germany, Germany was one of the most progressive places for queer people. Berlin was the Mecca, the gathering place across Europe for gay, lesbian, transvestites, all of these newly forming identities and practices, they all flocked. The first gay rights organization was created in 1896 in Berlin. 1896. There was an institute that was studying human sexuality and was advocating for Germany to decriminalize homosexuality in 1923. There was this burgeoning freedom that was being unlocked. And so I stood there at the bar enjoying this comedy, and I felt the presence of all of these queer ancestors who fought, who were killed for this moment to allow it to be happened, and I started to feel a shadow of the future. Because freedom gained is never freedom secured. Because there were drag shows in Germany 90 years ago. Before the Nazis took over and rounded up most of these people, people like me, into camps. I stood in between those two poles of what was, what might be, and tried to enjoy this moment. It was a profoundly mixed experience, if I'm honest. And it mirrors what I have sensed from many people after this recent midterm election, a feeling of profound I get a sense from my progressive friends that the gains that were made are real, that maybe some of the hemorrhaging that is going on may be stopped, and yet some of the propositions that we wanted to pass failed. Some of the work that we've been doing for decades didn't amount to much. We saw the way that voter suppression was pushing marginalized people away from their democratic rights. There were gains and losses. And all of this pointed to a deep division in the country. I mean, it's symbolic in the Houses of Congress being divided, but that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? The tip of the iceberg that goes much deeper, because this election saw openly white supremacist candidates running again. This election saw the rise of xenophobic and racist rhetoric being used to get votes. Those symptoms, that symbol of the divided house, are just the symptoms of a wound long festering in this country, a wound and division that probably goes back far before even this country was created. For the pains of slavery and genocides of indigenous peoples cast their shadows to us today. Now, one of my friends says a symptom is something halfway out. That a symptom is something halfway out. And there's hope, right, when we see the symptoms of white supremacy and xenophobia being more overt, because it's halfway out. We can heal it if we see it. And yet, halfway out means that there's more to come, too. After the results of the election, we started to hear the chorus like we usually do. This response to this division in the nation with a chorus of calls to seek common ground. And as I have heard, I watched the press conference with President Trump, in which he said he was willing to reach across the aisle to work for common ground as long as Congress didn't do their constitutionally mandated role of oversight. Nice, right? And I heard Nancy Pelosi, who may become the Speaker of the House, speak about common ground of working across the aisle for the betterment of the American people, and yet I was just struck with a deep discord in my heart, because for many marginalized people, meeting in the middle is a choice between utter destruction and most destruction. I felt that sense of those queer ancestors in Germany, that there was no common ground that they could find with the Nazis, right? There was no common ground that would be acceptable to them, that they could live in the ways that they would want to live under fascism. There was no fascism light that would be acceptable. Because the end, the sole end of fascism and the sole end of abuse is total domination and control. And meeting halfway is not tenable. It's like if your coworker walked up to you in the lunchroom and said, oh, that looks tasty, I'll take all of that. And you said no. And they said, fine, let's compromise. I'll just take half. Or maybe it's not your lunch, or maybe it's your house. It reminds me of the words of Tarani Jones, a Black novelist and professor, in her piece in Time magazine. When we revisit our shameful past, she writes, ask yourself, where was the middle? The search for the middle is rooted in conflict avoidance and denial. For many Americans, it is painful to understand that there are citizens of our country who are deeply racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic. Certainly, they reason this current moment is somehow a complicated misunderstanding, that perhaps there is some way to look at this, a view from the middle that would allow us to communicate and realize that our national identity is tied together in a comfortable bow of patriotism. The headlines that lament a divided America, she continues, suggest that the fact that we can't all get along is more significant than the issues over which we are sparring. The headlines that lament a divided America suggest that the fact that we can't all get along is more significant than the issues over which we are sparring. Now, all of this moment, both at the gay bar and watching the presidential elections, all of this made me think about the 2002 French election. And I know that all of you right now are searching through your mind for everything you know about the 2002 French election. You're coming back with polling returns and comparing and contrasting the French political system with ours. But I'm going to pause you for a moment and just fill you in on some of the details so you don't have to go that much back in your memory. So in 2002, France was having a national election. And how the presidential election works in France is that if the candidate for president doesn't get a certain percentage of the votes, they have a runoff. It's similar to what might happen in Georgia, depending on how the votes go. And so what that means is they eliminate all the candidates except the top two. And so in 2002, the center-left candidate was eliminated, was the lowest vote getter. I think there was 20 to 30%. And so the two candidates that the population in France were going to vote for were Jacques Chirac, who was the leader of the center-right party in France, and Jean-Marie Le Pen. Le Pen being the leader of the National Front, a openly racist and pseudo-fascist party in France. And so the electorate in France was faced with a decision about who they were going to vote for. Now, it was very clear for most of the people who voted for the center-left candidate that they would not be supporting Le Pen. And yet, the ballot was asking them who they were going to support. Were they going to show up to the polls to vote for someone in which they vehemently disagreed with his policies to prevent a fascist from getting elected? As Gary Young says, a political commentator, the French were stuck in a bind in which they had to figure out, was there a qualitative difference between merely a politician with terrible ideas and a politician who represents an existential threat to the current and future practice of democracy itself? Is there a difference between a politician or political party who I merely disagree with and who I think politics are dangerous, and ones that represent an existential threat to the practice of democracy itself? And so many French, they came out, they voted. Jacques Chirac was elected with 70-some percentage of the votes. And many of the people who showed up at a polling place needed some way of showing that they disliked this choice. So many of them showed up with clothespins on their noses. To live in a democracy, African American Unitarian Universalist political commentator Melissa Harris Perry says, to live in a democracy is to have the right to govern, not simply be governed, rule, not simply be ruled, heard, not silenced, and to lose without fearing that winners take all. It's on the front of your order of service. To live in a democracy is to have the right to govern, not simply be governed, rule, not to be ruled, heard, not silenced, and most importantly, to lose without fearing that winners take all. What she's getting at is that there's a baseline in a democratic system that when your political party doesn't win in the ways that you want it, you should not have to fear that all of your rights will be taken away. You should not have to fear that your right to vote would be taken away because of gerrymandering or voter suppression. You shouldn't have to fear that your right to exist and to express yourself in this free and democratic society would be hampered when the other side loses, or your side loses. And as Unitarian Universalists, we are strong supporters of democracy. But friends, we are not strong supporters of democracy because it is the most efficient way to ensure progressive values to be enacted in this country. Because it's not. Democracy is inherently conflictual. It's inherently ineffective. It's filled with a friction. For at the core of the democratic moment is when people from different walks of life, different cultures, different perspectives come together, converge, and figure out how to cooperate for the good of the whole. That's the core of what it means to be in a democracy. It is having faith in something good coming out, some creative potential arising when people come together. Democracy is a system of government that you should expect to lose as much as you'd win. It's a system of governance that says, I don't know everything. I might be mistaken about a lot of things. And you might be too. And so how do we craft a society that recognizes that each of us may not have all of the parts of the picture? Well, we create a society in which the fundamental way we govern is by coming together and figuring out as one ineffective, conflictual, awkward body how together we can maybe approximate truth and justice in a way that if I ran the whole thing, or if you did, we wouldn't be able to. But that democratic moment can only be achieved when a baseline set of rights and privileges remain untouched, no matter the outcome of an election. In this moment in which the calls for common ground echo deeply from many sides, it is time that we abandon common ground and instead choose a common humanity. For common humanity is affirming the very platform, the ways of relating that facilitate the democratic culture in the first place, the way of being that allows mutual and future flourishing for all people's perspectives to come to the table. Choosing humanity is not taking the politically expedient route if it undermines democracy in the first place. It's not lowering the threshold of votes to confirm your candidates. It's not scoring cheap political points and demonizing another group of people simply because you disagree with them. Choosing humanity is saying, from my perspective, that Mitt Romney may have really bad policies for this country, but I do not think he is an existential threat to democracy itself. It is not insisting on an ideological purity in which we are work when we work together. Because the way we fight this rise of pseudo-fascism and white nationalism, this rhetoric of hate, the way we fight it is to find those people that will hold the container with us. And the way we fight this rising fascism is not simply by voting. It's by addressing that deep wound at the core of the division. The deep wound that makes people say America is not great anymore. The deep wound that says this country has left them behind. This deep wound that says we were never important in this country in the first place. Because we can fight at the ballot box every time. Right now in France, Jean-Marie Le Pen's daughter is ahead of the National Front, and they're at 35-40% of the popular of the popularity right now. You can fight them at the ballot box once, but if that core wound at the center of it is not addressed, person to person, community to community, those real and perceived grievances, if they are not dealt with, there's nothing we can do. Because the heart of the matter, as I see it right now in this country, the true question of which we are grappling with is whether or not the white majority of this country actually wants to be a democracy and share power with people of color, or did our collective taste for democracy only last as long as white control of those democratic institutions was assured? Because the choice for us in this moment will be stark. The choice for us will be democracy and the survival of our souls and the lives of the marginalized, or a new form of neo-apartheid, both continued and enhanced, continuing a century again the domination of whiteness in this nation. Now, sometimes the role of the preacher is to give you hope, but I don't have any. Sorry, I really don't. I don't know if white America is up to this challenge of sharing power, of not scoring cheap points at another's expense, of figuring out how to hold the center of our democratic experiment. I don't know. What I do know is that my faith doesn't depend on optimism, because what I know is true is this. Hitler didn't need to rise. Apartheid in South Africa didn't need to fall. Choosing humanity is not inevitable, nor is it easy, but with every breath and every ballot, with every heart devoid of denial, with every hand reaching out in care, with every drag queen lip-syncing for her life, we are gifted the possibility of this beautiful yet broken world taking the shape of justice for a heartbeat. And then another, and then another. I do not know if we are up to this task, but I know it is our work to do. May we do our best, because everything's at stake. Amen.